Are we ready?
Absolutely.
Hi, I'm Simon Mercip and welcome to Crave. This is the video cast and podcast dedicated to music and film and just about anything and everything that's been entertaining me and Steve McCabe lately.
And there's been a decent amount this week, to be fair, Simon, and stuff coming up very shortly as well. So in some ways, we've got quite the nostalgia trip going, haven't we?
We do.
So we've got... I love what you've written in the script here. I'm not sure I can do this. I'm going to have to. Simon and I caught the last train to the Auckland Town Hall.
What can I be referring to?
Yes, well, it wasn't to Clarksville, but it was to see the monkeys, or at least two monkeys.
Yes.
Hey, it's some monkeys.
It's some monkeys.
Some, an unspecified number of monkeys. and they monkeyed around.
They did, yeah. And the word patchy came to mind for me.
And I think I'll be going with you on that
okay.
one.
Yes. All right. So we're going to talk about the monkeys. We've also both seen quite recently another piece of music or another musical career to talk about, but this time not on stage, but at the cinema. And this is the Elton John biopic called Rocket Man.
Oh, yes.
And I guess it's only a year since we saw Bohemian Rhapsody, another film of another huge British act. So I guess there are some inevitable comparisons. So there's quite a bit to talk about.
Well, given that they share a director, there's obviously going to be overlap. And then, kind of an updated version of a bit of nostalgia. Now, obviously, you saw the original Aladdin film, didn't you?
Way because... back 1992.
Exactly, yes. I mean, anybody of our generation who's had kids back then has memorised that film, right?
I know.
Pretty much.
Yes.
And so Disney, obviously, seen the dollar signs, have done the remake. And so we'll be talking about that in a few minutes.
Good.
Right.
And just as a little snapshot at the end, a film I caught several thousand metres up in the air on a flight.
As you do.
recently. It was touted as Robert Redford's last acting role.
Right.
It's a film called The Old Man and the Gun. I remember when it came out, I thought, I wouldn't mind seeing that. One of those ones I didn't get around to.
Right.
And actually, sometimes a flight is not a bad way to catch up with a few things.
Captive audience.
Indeed it is. So anyway, I'm going to have a quick word about Robert Redford a bit later as well.
Sounds good to me. So we'll start with live music, right?
Yeah. Yes.
So Sunday night, Auckland Town Hall.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, I mean, I saw two monkeys.
Yeah.
Last time they were here, 2016, it was Mickey DeLentz and it was Peter Tork.
Right.
Now, Peter Tork wasn't on this tour for the obvious reason that he's not on this planet any longer. He died back in February of this year.
Yes. So
presumably it's before this tour was conceived, we're going to assume, because it was always conceived as the Mike and Mickey show.
Yeah.
So we had DeLentz again.
Yes.
We've got Michael Nesmith.
Yes. Yes. So actually I think it's really worthwhile to set out for our audience the difference between having DeLentz and Tork, which you saw the first time.
Oh, yes, big difference.
And what we saw the other night. So, for example, a couple of nights ago, Mike Nesmith and Mickey DeLentz were both occupying centre stage.
Yes,
that's
they
not
were.
What happened, I think you told me, with the previous tour.
No, it wasn't. When I saw him the last time, Peter Tork was very much the front man.
Yeah.
Very much so. Mickey DeLentz, some of the time was at the front with a guitar around his neck playing, some of the time he was singing from behind a drum kit.
Okay.
So he went backwards and forwards. But although he was obviously a significant contributor to the show, it was very much Peter Tork who was the front man. He was the one with all the stage patter. He very much led the show.
Wow. Okay, so that is not what we got.
Not even remotely.
In this last show,
no.
Not at all.
In fact, the last show, and it's such a nostalgia thing, we're actually talking about the show before this one, right? But that show, and there's a point to mentioning this.
Yes.
Right around the corner at the ASB Theatre, instead of at the Town Hall, and on a projected screen behind, there was a lovely video backdrop, and it was, as you can imagine, this being the monkeys, quite psychedelic. But it opened with, quite literally, the theme from the monkeys.
Right. Hey, we're the monkeys.
Yes, with the video going with it that was the opening titles for the TV show.
Okay.
And as I was watching it, I went, oh, right, yes. Oh, yes. and even I haven't seen this show in, I don't want to think how many decades.
Yes.
It all came flooding back.
Absolutely.
Right? So excellent. So suddenly this time we're at the Town Hall. No stage set to speak of whatsoever. Not even a video backdrop.
No.
You've just got a six-piece-ish.
Oh, well, if you include the backing singers, it was even more. I think that was quite a big band.
It was, wasn't it?
Yeah. Because you had Dolenz and Nesmith.
Yeah.
I think there were three other guitarists.
Well, there was a bass player. There was a pedal steel player.
Yes. There was a lead, another lead guitarist called who had Nesmith as his name.
Well, I looked up that it's Christian. That's actually Mike's boy.
And then there was the musical director also on a guitar on the other side of the stage.
Yes, there was.
Then you had a keyboard player, drummer, and two backing singers.
One of whom was Mickey Dolenz's sister.
Yes. So it actually was a pretty big band and a big sound.
And a good band.
Yeah, good band.
The drummer was fantastic.
Very good.
But that was it. So there was a drummer who wasn't Mickey Dolenz.
Yes.
And I mean, I've got no idea how good he is anymore, but the lad whose name I didn't catch who was drumming, he was fantastic.
Yep.
Really impressed. And then the one thing that we're not talking about, for obvious reasons, because we can't bring ourselves to have to discuss it, you've got Mike Nesmith.
Yeah.
Trying to front the show.
Yeah. And so this is where... on the one hand, with Peter Tork passing away, and yes, he, as you told us, you know, he was an energetic and quite charismatic frontman.
Yes, he was.
Sound of it. Well, I remember, and I put this in my review on our website, cravepodcast.com, I remember the TV show very fondly.
Of course.
I remember Nesmith's presence, even as a kid, I remember. Yeah. And he just came across, even back then, as the more, I suppose, intellectual one, the quieter one, little bit nerdy, little bit anxious even, not the one who was out there to grab the limelight. He was obviously a songwriter and a guitarist and probably a guy who was quite responsible for the overall sound, but not a charismatic frontman.
Not a clown like the three were.
No, and so I think that probably was who he was, and that is who he remains. And so you get a show with Dolenz doing his best to be the frontman, right next to Nesmith, who isn't that guy.
No. So Dolenz still sounds like he's having a fantastic time.
Yep.
Nesmith, I was starting to wonder, has he had a stroke?
I wondered about that too.
I mean, I'm not trying to be
cruel
here.
That because, thought came to my mind
I mean,
too.
There were a number of occasions when Dolenz would say something. It's pretty routinely, broadly slapsticky American comedy.
Yeah.
And Nesmith would try and respond to it. And you turned to me a few times with a look on your face and said, what the hell's going on that stage?
Yeah.
And it wasn't in a sort of a, this is really crazy, this is exciting. No. It was like incoherence.
Yeah, yeah. There was some mumbling there that I didn't pick up myself.
Yeah.
And there was a point at one in the concert where his iPad crashed and so he obviously needed that for these songs, which he's sung many, many times.
Yeah.
So that thought flashed to my mind too, whether he's just maybe a little unwell in some respects.
Well, I mean, he's 76 years old.
So that's, yeah.
I mean, he's of an age when things do start to wear down.
Sure,
I didn't notice. I'd love to know, since you mentioned the iPad, I don't know if you picked up on this.
What?
Young woman came out to try and fix the iPad.
Yes.
I've got no idea who she is.
No.
She looked like she's probably in her 20s or so. And she stood in front of me, using the microphone stand. She leaned over a little bit like this to fix the iPad. And as he's doing it, he was giving it some John Key.
Yeah.
And when
a pat on the head here, or stroking the hair.
It was a stroke. It wasn't a pat. It was a stroke of the back of the hair. And maybe it's his daughter, his granddaughter. I don't know. If it's not, then seriously, mate, I think we need a word.
Yes. So the point about all this is that, you know, they played the songs you'd expect, the big hits plus other songs.
A lot of songs you wouldn't expect.
And a lot of songs I wasn't familiar with, to be fair.
Yeah, let's be honest about
this.
But
I enjoyed most of the music I enjoyed. And the big songs I also really enjoyed. And they really did take me back to being a kid and watching them on TV. But as an overall show of 2019 that was going to capture you, Dolenz was working hard and trying to give Nesmith credit for all his songwriting prowess over the years.
Oh, repeatedly, yes.
But you just had a little bit of a sense that there was someone who was bumbling his way through it. His vocals occasionally were okay and occasionally weren't, I thought.
Oh, yes.
And it kind of did detract a little bit from the show. And I would say, Steve, that the audience sensed this.
It wasn't a very excited audience, was it?
I just think they wanted to enjoy it more than they were enjoying it.
Yes.
And I think they were very well disposed to them. And I think they're well disposed to Nesmith. I just think everyone sort of had this feeling in their gut that not all as well, perhaps.
No, and I definitely think he kind of benefited from a lot of goodwill and affection.
That's okay, but and maybe just the fact that there are only two left and there they were,
yes,
is it's in itself something to acknowledge and to celebrate, and that's fantastic. But it wasn't an A-grade show.
No, it really wasn't, which is an awful shame.
Yeah.
Because Mickey Dolenz, let's be honest, is still a phenomenal singer.
He's got a good voice. I mean, as you said, they're getting on, these guys.
He's 74.
Okay, well, he did pretty well.
And I always thought he was the strongest singer in the band anyway, to be fair. And so when he did songs like I'm a Believer,
yep,
which sounded fantastic, that was what they closed with.
Yeah.
But yeah, they opened with... I can't remember what they opened with now, but...
Well, I know that Last Train was the second song.
Last Train
it?
To Clarksville when it came in second.
Yes.
And then after that, we had two dozen songs that I knew two because they were from the album Good Times, which came out about three years ago.
Yeah.
I remember you though they started playing Me and Magdalena, you turned to me and said, oh, I quite like this one.
Yeah.
But other than that, they weren't the songs I think people were there to hear.
No.
And I think part of that is like, I mean, one song, for example, that I personally do quite like is My Auntie Griselda.
Mm-hmm.
It's an odd song, but it's a very strongly Peter Tork song.
Right.
And with Tork dead,
yes,
I think maybe they've consciously retired that because it's not Daydream Believer.
No.
And so I think possibly they decided not to play it because it wasn't their song.
No.
But then, oddly, we also didn't get the theme from the Monkees.
No, that was noticeable from it by its absence. Yeah. Well, look. I'm glad I can now say I've seen the surviving Monkees, and I'm very pleased to have done so. And there was some genuine, delightful, nostalgic moments through those well-known songs. And as you say, Mickey Dolenz sang them well. It just was a little odd, a little. Awkward at times.
Yes, awkward's a great word for it.
Yeah.
I mean, I've now seen three of the four Monkees.
Yeah, you have.
In various permutations.
Yes.
Obviously, Davy Jones, obviously, we'll never see.
No, not Davy Smith, by the way.
No, yes. yes, him neither. The fifth Monkey that no one ever talks about.
In case you're wondering, I mistakenly referred to David Jones as David Smith in an earlier conversation with Steve, and he probably thought, what is this guy on?
Anyway. Yes. So no one you were disappointed at the show.
Yes.
But to be fair, in their defence, Nesmith has commented that that after he's done these shows, and they're also going over to the West Island to do a couple of shows in Australia.
Yes.
And he said, basically, that's it. This will be the last shows I play as the Monkees.
Fair enough.
76 years old. I think it might be time to hang up the 12 string.
Anyway, so we've witnessed a bit of pop history.
We have indeed. History.
Yes, wasn't that a lovely little move?
We did, you did.
It's kind of interesting, isn't it? 1 year after a really, really successful commercial-wise and critically-wise film about a British pop giant act, Queen, comes another. But equally, in some people's eyes, probably a bigger act. I don't know. It's all very subjective. But...
Well, he does mention at one point during the film that there was one stage where he was accounting for something like a quarter of all record sales in the world.
Yes.
And we have to assume that that's actually a historical fact. Well, it's certainly pretty mind-blowing, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. So we're talking Elton John, obviously, in the film Rocket Man. There are some inevitable comparisons with Bohemian Rhapsody, but I have to say I enjoyed Rocket Man. I've just seen it before recording our podcast and videocast today. I enjoyed it a lot. I found it a more serious drama for me than Bohemian Rhapsody.
Yes.
Whereas in a Bohemian Rhapsody, Freddie Mercury's parents come across as quite generally good-natured and not unsupportive by any means.
Well, no, they didn't understand to begin with, but very quickly, once they saw, then they came around and they embraced their son.
Yeah.
And it was all a bit cheesy.
Yeah, whereas here we have a very, very different, a much darker tale of a young lad desperate to find some love within his home and not really finding it.
So we've got various characters, actors playing the three ages of Elton.
Yes.
You've got the little lad, Matthew, who plays seven-year-old Reggie. Very brief appearance of teenage Reggie.
Mm-hmm.
And then obviously Taron Egerton takes over as adult Elton.
Yes.
But you've got Bryce Dallas Howard as a cold, cold mother.
Yeah. I've only seen her in playing roles in American films. I always assumed she was American, but if she is, she did a pretty good British accent, I thought.
She said, well, I didn't realise until the credits rolled.
She's been in Jurassic Park the last couple of films.
That's where I know her from, yeah. I didn't even realise it was her. She sounded authentically London.
She did.
She really did. And also, she played it as being a little bit cold and a little bit unpleasant.
Yeah. Like, well, the way that quite early on in the film, we hear the song The Bitch Is Back.
Yes.
And it seems a very clear direct reference to Mum.
Quite possibly, yes.
That's how I took it, the way it was placed in the film. So
That does seem reasonable, yeah. You've also got Gemma Jones as Ivy, who was never specifically identified as such, but obviously his grandmother.
Right, right.
And then who else have we got? Stephen McIntosh plays Stanley, who is Mr. Dwight.
Right.
Who is played as the coldest of cold fish.
Mm-hmm.
Miserable bugger.
Yes.
And so you can see exactly where Reg wanted to become Elton, wanted to become something different. And you can also see where everything that was going to go wrong later in his life came from. So what I put in my review on the website, and I'll stand by this, is this was Elton in therapy.
Yes, it was.
I mean, the framing device of the film literally is him going through therapy at some sort of addiction support group.
Yes, yes.
That's how the film starts.
Yeah.
With this apparently not actually literally happening, but something very similar to this happens. It's got him, it depicts him storming out of a performance. Apparently he actually cancelled the show.
Right.
And walking into a meeting still in his full stage costume.
Yes.
And he declares, "My name is Elton Hercules John, and I'm alcoholic."
And a lot of other things
And a drug addict, yeah. And so as the film progresses, you see in routinely it goes back to him in further rehab meetings.
Yes.
And you'll notice he's taking off the costume.
Yes.
And eventually you see him just wearing a robe.
Yes.
And so this is actually literally him working through his demons.
Yes, it is.
In the film. I mean, he's got a producer credit. He's clearly involved with the film very closely.
Yeah.
His husband's got an executive producer credit. This is Elton's film.
It is. And I think that something I really appreciated in this film was having right up at the top this clear explanation about what he went through as a young child.
Yes.
Because I've always found Elton John a guy who I've found his music, it's just classic.
It's untouchable,
timeless,
isn't it?
Music. But in the odd interview I've seen of him, I've always had the sense that he's a bit of a prickly bugger, a little arrogant, a little touchy, a little, I don't know. Yeah, doesn't take to fools kindly type of bloke.
Yeah.
And so I wasn't a guy I thought I would warm to. And actually the way Taron Egerton plays him, he's not the most warm and cuddly sort of bloke, but we know why.
Yes.
The film tells us why, and because it tells us why, it gives us something to hold on to and to help to guide us through the rest of the film. So as a result, it becomes quite a satisfying drama.
Yes, it does, because it shows he was abused badly by his parents emotionally. Mm. You've got an amazing performance from Richard Madden.
Yeah, actually, that is a very good... Yeah, I agree.
As what was his name? John Reed, who basically tried to be his Svengali and screwed him around in a number of different ways.
Yes.
And so it does depict Elton's, A, suffering yet another bout of emotional abuse at the hand of somebody who purports to love him but really doesn't.
Yes.
But then it's very, very clear that he spiraled down into all manner of addiction, and he doesn't try and pretend. I mean, going back to Bohemian Rhapsody, because the comparisons are inevitable.
Yes,
there's no way you can have these two films back to back without comparing them.
No.
So in Bohemian Rhapsody, it was very clear that Freddie just never quite met the right girl.
Yeah.
Whereas in Rocketman, it's absolutely unapologetic. This is who Elton John is.
Yeah.
You are going to deal with it.
Yeah.
He is, he's gay.
Yeah.
And Bohemian Rhapsody was terrified of admitting.
Yes.
They were reluctant even to come out and declare him bisexual.
Yes.
But there's a wonderful, wonderful, it's actually quite horrible coming out scene.
Yes.
In Rocketman.
Yeah, yeah.
Which gets a bad response from a parent, but not, the response was worse than you'd imagine.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it's saying, look, this is what I went through.
Yeah.
But then it does, possibly the one misstep in the film for me, I'm willing to forgive it because the rest of it was so brilliant, was it's like he sinks to the very depths.
Yes.
And it's almost like a scene from Tommy.
Right.
And okay. You know the scene I'm talking about,
yes,
right?
Yes, yeah. Depths is a good word.
And that felt a little bit creepy to me. But then there was almost literally a resurrection.
Yes. Well, I just want to pick up on the two things there. I give credit to the sort of the bravery of the writers, and I guess Elton John okayed this, that he was much more willing to be upfront about, as you say, his addictions, his sleeping around, much more so than Bohemian Rhapsody.
Yes.
So it gives the drama a lot more weight and heft, and maybe makes it a little less light entertainment,
yeah.
But gives tick for its credibility. Yeah, well, I don't know. This issue about the comeback or the bounce back from hitting the wall and coming back again. Well, apparently, if you are, you either die from your addictions, or you do hit. There's some sort of wall you hit, and you, to which you say to yourself, "That's it. I cannot go any further."
So, I don't doubt it for a second that something happened like that.
Yes.
It's as though it was depicted. Just felt a little bit.
Yeah.
But like I said, the rest of the film was so passionate and so glorious. The way that the music was incorporated, unlike Bohemian Rhapsody, which was like intended to be a strictly linear historical document.
Yeah. Yes.
And then you get all the arguments of, well, actually, they didn't play that album on that tour. Mm. Then you're saying, oh, come on.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, they played the songs in a different order in that particular show. And basically, it's Trainspotting at that point.
Yes, yes.
But Rocketman makes no attempt whatsoever.
No, it's kind of a fantastical voyage in some respects.
Yes. It's, in that regard, it's more like Mamma Mia.
Yeah, I suppose it is.
Because it's an old school musical.
Yeah.
It's not, the songs aren't there because it's part of a historical document, which is what Bohemian Rhapsody was trying to do.
No.
The songs are there because they drive the narrative.
Yes, they are.
So Saturday Night's All Right for Fighting is an amazing sequence,
yes,
isn't it?
Yeah. I agree. I think there was a lot of invention and creativity that went into the staging of the songs and the conceptualizing of them. And they're not necessarily what you'd expect. They're not necessarily in the order you'd expect.
No.
And I found that really, really engaging. I thought that was great. And I suppose we just better just talk a bit about the lead actor.
Taron Egerton,
I think that I think he did a good job of taking a guy who, in some respects, was not the most likable character.
No, you're saying this, yeah.
But still giving us enough to understand him and care about what happened to him, even in his most petulant rock star way, decadent moments. There were some genuine touching moments that he got across. And the other thing is, as I understand it, he sang all the songs. I think that's right.
I listened to an interview with him just the other day. He turned down our request for interviews. I know. It must have been busy, because otherwise I'm sure he would have talked to us. Yeah. And so did Elton as well.
Yes.
But regardless of that, apparently he did actually sing.
Yeah.
That was him. And some of it, when it was feasible, it was actually him singing live.
Okay.
Now, obviously, songs like Saturday Night's All Right for Fighting, you'd have to see the film, wouldn't you, to understand the scale of the production
It's an amazing
piece of work.
Yes.
That, there's no way in the world you could actually do that live. It's just not feasible.
Yes.
But for, I'm trying to think of, you know, like, for example, when he's doing Your Song, and we see him actually writing it.
Yeah.
That was him live. As he was sitting there trying to find the right key on the piano keyboard, and he's trying to pitch it. Apparently, that was him.
Right, and that actually just so one of the thing. One of the things I enjoyed about Bohemian Rhapsody and this film is you get these insights into how great songs are created. I didn't realise that Elton John was such a prodigy at an early age.
Me neither.
He had this incredible gift for picking a melody, following. I mean, almost like a savant.
Yes,
I think that was a really interesting part of the film, well depicted. So I would recommend it really strongly. It's not, as I said, it doesn't have the light touch of Bohemian Rhapsody, but I think it's really worthwhile.
There are two other people that we've not mentioned that we really do to mention, though.
I suppose Bernie Taupin needs a mention.
Yeah, Jamie Bell as plays Bernie Taupin, who, you know, without whom there basically wouldn't have been an Elton John, pretty much.
Yeah, and it's an incredibly important relationship throughout the film. And in some ways, the most important relationship.
Yes.
In terms of, for his career, anyway. And that was, I think, really nicely done because it gave us a sense of, loyalty.
Yes.
True friendship and loyalty. And yes, okay, it's tied to the success of how well the songs did, but they kept at it, and as we saw, you know, they're still
very, 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 very dear friends. Yeah.
So that was a really nice part of the film, actually.
Yeah, but the one thing that I can't let pass without comment because it was so brilliant.
Yes,
it's a bit part, but Stephen Graham as Dick James, the music entrepreneur who actually introduces those two guys.
Oh, right. Yes.
I mean, it's a small part. But have you ever seen anyone having so much fun with a role?
Yeah, that was great. So this is early on. This is the first guy who kind of was managing Elton John, right? Is that the one you under with the young fellow, the older one?
The older guy, yes.
Yeah, it was a great scenery-chewing performance. Yeah. Lovely.
I'm going to have a massage. It's possibly the finest line of the film. It was wonderful.
No, very good. I agree.
Even without him, it would have been a magnificent film. But he was just the...
He was great.
He was lovely. So Rocket Man, what do you reckon, Simon? Are we going to recommend this?
Absolutely. Very much so. Yep. More than I expected. And that was always a pleasant surprise. And I would recommend it as much as I'd recommend Bohemian Rhapsody. Maybe even a little more. I think it might even been a better film as a drama, for sure.
Yes, absolutely.
Yep.
She packed my bags last night, pre-flight. 0 hour, 9 a.m. And I'm gonna be high as a kite by then. I miss the earth so much, I miss my life. It's lonely out in space on such a timeless flight.
Part of their 2019 series, the Auckland Theatre Company are staging A Fine Balance, based on the novel by Rohinton Mystery, at the Kew Theatre, opening on June the 14th, this coming Saturday. So yesterday I caught up with two of the stars of the show, Mel Odedra and Rashmi Palapitiya. Right, so we are at the Kew Theatre, and I'm joined today by Rashmi Palapitiya and Mel Odedra, who are going to be appearing in the upcoming performance of A Fine Balance, based on the novel by Rohinton Mystery. So tell us a little bit, if you wouldn't mind, first of all, about the story. What's The Fine Balance all about?
It's really, it boils down to perseverance, hope and humanity.
Okay.
It's based in India during the emergency in the 70s.
Right.
So this is an incredibly dark period of history in India, where Indira Gandhi essentially was... There's a big lead up to the event, but it came down to her being finally accused of cheating in the elections.
Right.
And so she set up an emergency, rewrote the constitution.
Yeah.
Put the nation in the fear of grip. And all of this plays out through the lives of four or five characters on stage.
So, I mean, it's a very long book. I know that. I read it several years. It was one of the fantastic books I've ever read. Reduced it down to a 2-hour performance. So what's the essence of the story? What are you going to be capturing? You say perseverance.
Yeah.
I think in some ways the title Fine Balance means how does one find a fine balance through a strong caste system which has... can have horrific events in your life, depending on where you sit in it. So how does a mass population find a balance in there? How do you survive that? And I think in Rohinton Mysteries, in the novel to the stage play, it's about humanity.
Yeah.
And at some level, we're all just people trying to live, trying to not be lonely, trying to have a makshift family.
Absolutely. If you take it away from the Indian context, it's actually just how we as humans survive. You know, the biggest drive that we have to stay alive, and you see that through the various levels of society in India where it's based, and everybody has a different drive.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just really, it is about that. It's about how do you survive when life really chucks all it has at you, and you don't. I mean, even at the end, you know, there's a glimmer of hope still there. The worst things that you can imagine happen to the main characters.
Yes,
all of them are broken down. Essentially, their lives are taken away from them, and they're just deconstructed. But there's still an element of hope,
right,
that carries them through.
So I know you play Om Prakash,
that's right,
who does get some very, very shabby treatment.
Yeah.
at the hands of some of the characters in the book. We should avoid spoilers, but how do you locate a character like that? How do you find the hope in a character like that?
I guess part of me my cultural background is Indian, and that's one of the things that being an Indian, you realise it's very easy to get blinkered into a view of India being dirty. Full of horrors. I mean, you know, everybody versus, you know, arranged marriages and caste system. It's not just that, you know, the India to me is quite, I mean, coming from there, having background there, it's a beautiful place.
Yeah.
You know, it's been around, I think I was reading the other day, it's the oldest surviving single religious culture in the world.
Really?
It's absolutely ancient, and that any of the ancient Vedic texts, etc., that you read in the culture, they're written to help you school yourself in life, if you know what I mean. So the people of India, they've got this great warmth about them and this hope. It's an undying hope.
Right.
And part of it comes from the whole the reincarnation part of the culture. But the other side of it is as well. It's when you don't have anything, you don't have anything to lose. You really don't have anything to lose,
right?
For me, it was to draw on the experiences of people back at the villages, the characters that I met like this, and also how was I when I was, in the book, he's 17,
right?
And establishing some of the cheekiness of youth, you know, getting to that youth as you get older and you get mature and you start to, things take different priorities, but scrambling that backwards, I mean, I've become a real horrible person at home. I'm always going to be like a kid.
this is method acting taken to the extreme. Yeah. Good man. Excellent. So Rashmi, you're playing, is it Dina Anty?
Yeah.
Who is kind of like the emotional sort of pivot of the story, really.
Yeah.
So you have to sort of pretty much underpin the entire story. Yes, and obviously this being an audio recording,
you don't have to state the stakes so high.
No one can see the look of abject horror on your face when I said that. Why did it fill you with such dread?
I beg your pardon.
Why did that suggestion fill you with such fear and horror?
I mean, today's day one of production week, and I know some other cast members are aware that I'm feeling quite overwhelmed.
Oh, okay.
Because I feel like it's a fantastic piece of writing to get to interpret as an actor, like the chance to get a role like this.
Yeah.
And it's also historical that we have a relationship with ATCN Prias, and we're sort of showcasing work and maybe taking... lifting the invisibility of South Asians in a Pacific New Zealand setting,
right?
Sort of bringing it into a current where of sort of middle New Zealand where folks might consume theatre,
right?
So I feel that responsibility, and I just want to be a human being in the story, so and keep it universal.
Yes, but that Just come back to what Mel was saying. It's a very human story, even though it's set within a particular cultural context.
Yeah.
You've got four people who are absolutely dependent upon each other.
Absolutely. I mean, if you could flip the India context and make this in Dickens' England with Oliver Twist and Fagin, you know, or transform it into another place with... feudal powers operating.
Right, yeah, yeah.
Well, you can even bring it right up to date, you know.
To our homeless people in
just
New
right
Zealand
now,
today.
Outside the front door of Kew.
Yeah.
You know, you'll see people out there asking for money. You've got people walking past at the other end of the spectrum who choose to ignore them. You've got other people who will walk past and donate money. It's an ever-dying story. You know, it just happens to be based in the 70s.
Yes.
But the lessons in there are just as germane to today as they are to the characters in that book.
Right.
Because I reckon what the sort of 2019 Queen Street that you see is the effects of sort of neoliberal policy from the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you want to see what the gap between rich and poor looks like, come on down to 2019, because there's heaps of people sleeping on the streets. You know, there's families that can't afford rent.
Right. I mean, I guess they're getting a different kind of rough treatment from the characters that you guys are depicting in A Fine Balance, but... fundamentally, the concept remains the same,
And this idea that we're all dependent on each other.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, Dino's dependent, the character Dinobai is dependent on others, Mrs. Gupta, etc. Even though she's the power wielding, almost a matriarchal figure in the beginning, you know. But then you get this other side where the tailors hold power over Dina.
Right.
It's all these.
Now, when we say the tailors, we're talking about Om Prakash
and Ishwar.
Thank you. I couldn't remember the name of the other character. Yeah.
So they hold, even though they don't realise immediately, they do hold power over Dina. Maliku comes in, the nephew.
Yes.
The fourth, you know, he holds power over
Dina.
So there's this, and it continues today. You know, I mean, look at from our perspective of actors. From what you were saying, they're bringing this the Asian actors, Southeast Asian actors into the forelight. You know, I mean, we're all dependent on who's making those casting decisions, who's putting the plays on. So we all feel this dependency on each other, but it works both ways.
Yeah,
you know. So absolutely.
So do you still feel that? I mean, let's branch out a little bit. You were talking before again about raising the profile of Southeast Asian or South Asian actors. What do you think this will lead to? Are you still going to be Indian actors, or are you just going to be actors?
That's an interesting question. I mean,
and a great question.
Yeah, no, it is. when I came to New Zealand, you know, you had a couple of characters on Shorten Street.
Yeah.
And that was it in terms of Indian representation.
A box has been nicely ticked.
Move
on, yeah.
Move forward, and I started getting into acting again. I was the first Indian actor in ATC to play. So that was huge, and it was at this place in the round. So it was like, wow. So it's a big thing. Move forward again, it's escalated to T last year. which was workshopped with ATC previously, and that was an all Southeast Asian cast. First time ever a play had been done with just Southeast Asian on a story that was written specifically for that, that you know, the people that are in it. Moving forward now, we've got a whole bunch of new Indian Southeast Asian actors, Sri Lankan, Southeast Tamil, all sorts that have come through from Prius as well as professionally, who are putting on a production now, again, outside of, I guess, independent producers, where now this is with ATC and Prius coming together. All the way through that, I can only see it getting stronger and stronger. But am I an Indian? Well, absolutely, I'm an Indian actor, because I am Indian.
Right.
And when I walk into that audition room, that's the first thing somebody sees.
Yes.
But above that, I'm an actor.
Right.
And that's the, I think that's the overarching piece that I'd like people that are, you know, the casting directors, the directors, etc., that are watching this to go out and say, yeah, they're a fine bunch of actors out there. Mm. You know.
Well, let's recast the question very slightly. Indian and Rashmi, you're not actually of Indian background, are you? Sri Lankan, right?
Yeah, I'm Sinhalese and
right.
I'm Sri Lankan.
Right. But let's be honest about this. In New Zealand,
that
degree of subtlety of distinction isn't always present, is it?
Yeah.
Sadly. You know,
yeah.
But
pan subcontinent.
Yes, vaguely of the Indian persuasion,
yeah.
Yes. So I guess what I'm wondering then is, at the moment, we've got Indian Sri Lankan actors in very much an Indian story.
Yeah.
When are we going to start to see Indian Sri Lankan, Pakistani, Bangladeshi actors in a New Zealand story? I see you're in Shortland Streets. You were in Gormsby, I believe, yeah?
Yeah.
One of those fantastic sitcoms I've ever seen. But very much, as you were saying, you know, there's a degree to which a box was getting ticked. By having one of those characters in the story. When are we going to see full representation, let's say?
Well, I think it's getting that way. I mean, I don't know, it's a long journey and it's a long way to go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Certainly all this, at the moment, diversity is fantastic, you know, and for actors of a different background or a different colour or, you know, just that are different to your main white actors,
yeah,
it's a ball started rolling. And it can only get better and better. And to be honest, it's one of these things. I mean, you know, my first name, Mel.
Mm-hmm.
I say my first name is really Miramanji, but Mel was because my English friends couldn't pronounce my name once I got drunk. So it's kind of stuck with me. So when you see Mel, you can see there's this strange juxtaposition.
Yes.
This guy is not white.
Because to be fair, the surname could pass as Irish, couldn't it?
Irish, I've heard Irish, Italian.
Oh, of course, yes.
It's the whole lot, you know, I used to get mail with O apostrophe.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Ironically, that used to really benefit me when I went for work interviews.
Right.
So, you know, you'd get through, I'd be on the phone, they'd get a mail editor through, and then you'd walk into the reception area, and the receptionist would be, can I help you? And I'd go, I'm here for an interview.
Yeah.
Oh. Your name, Mel, and sit down, and then you see the guy coming or the lady coming to interview you.
Yeah,
and they would just look around and they'd walk off again. And
yeah,
come back half an hour later, and certainly not Mel in here. So it has benefited me in that sense, but I'm seeing certainly more and more representation for not just Indians, and that's the thing as well. That I mean, it's not just it's not just about Southeast Asian actors, it's about getting people of different backgrounds, different ethnicities across the board. And having their stories told, not just being a part of somebody else's story,
right?
Because of that tick the box, it's actually having stories for us, for people of different backgrounds, different cultures, different ethnicities, and having their stories with them in it as well.
Right.
You know?
Sounds good. Mm. So the play's going to open this coming weekend. It's going to be opening. I think you said opening night is
Saturday.
Excellent. What's the production going to look like? Are we doing this with the full stage set? Is it very minimalist? What are we going to see on stage?
We will be playing In the Round.
Ooh.
So there's a slight Brechtian element there, that nothing is really hidden.
Mm-hmm.
The audience are as much alive with the actors waiting to go on or those who are living in the space. We're beautifully lit, if I can say that, midway through our lighting plot.
Well, this is Q Theatre. They do tend to do it well here, don't they?
Yeah.
They do. Yeah, we're also playing on a terracotta floor with wooden boards and a grill.
Great, yeah.
And that's going to look like, it's going to have to look like slums, someone's apartment, someone's office, someone's hospital.
The quarry where they're working is like, I don't know if you've been to India yet. It's a really...
No, I haven't.
It's not yet. It's such a rich, colourful place. You know, even the people just had this fascination or this love of bright colours. And it's a rich place. And Ahi, the director, I think he's going to put that richness on stage.
Right.
So we've got tea carts coming in. We've got people dressed in all sorts of different... colours and different clothes from different areas, you know, representing the different groups of people that
right.
live there. The smells, the finished product of tea, we had tea leaves everywhere, just it was just, you walked in and you got this aroma, which made it a 4D experience in some ways.
Yes.
So,
and I feel like this time there's a, like a fabulous creative marriage with Ahi, the director, I think it's David McCabe, the set designer, our lighting designer, Padma Akula, our costume designer, who's got a brilliant eye for colour. And it's like all their visions are have made a really great arranged marriage
right.
or a great meeting to maybe say, hey, remember that amazing 865-page novel? Well, now it's 99 pages.
Right.
And let's convey as much of the text that isn't there through these, visual design, the design
right.
of the show.
So it's going to be a very immersive experience for the audience, is what you're saying there, yeah?
We hope so, yeah.
Indeed, yeah, yeah.
Well, thank you very, very much for your time today. I really appreciate you taking the time. And I know you're getting nervous because you're getting close to opening night. So thank you so much for taking the time to talk about it. So Melo Dedra and Rashmi Pillapathia, thank you very much for talking to us today.
Thank you.
So,
okay.
now Simon, since everything old is new again.
Exactly.
Aladdin, have you seen Aladdin?
I've seen an Aladdin.
Okay.
I remember seeing 27 years ago.
Wow.
The animated version of
right.
Aladdin with, of course, Robin Williams as Aladdin. And
no.
That, yeah, true.
No, it's not Robin Williams as Aladdin. But
as the genie.
But the fact that you said that...
Yeah, sorry. Yes.
Basically, everything I have to say about it.
Okay. Well, let me just say, Robert Williams as the genie in Aladdin, that was one of the great performances in modern comedic cinema. I mean, it was wonderful, and he won awards for it. It's very... When I saw there was a live version coming up, I thought, I don't know, it's a damn hard act to top. Even though it was animated, I mean, he just put so much into that. So I haven't gone to see the remake. I haven't gone to see how Will Smith fares in this role. I kind of would expect him to be energetic, but not quite to have the zing of Mr. Williams. But you tell me, I'm...
Right. So here's the deal, right? So first of all, we know the story. There's no,
yes.
We don't even need to recap
no,
it, because it's anyone who's got any interest in this will know this, the story of Aladdin, the street rats in Agrabah, who befriends Jasmine, who turns out to be the daughter of the Sultan. I couldn't remember his job title for a second. and obviously then there's Jafar, the vizier, who wants to take over, and Aladdin ends up getting the magic lantern, out pops the genie. We know the story from there.
Mm.
And this is a very, very faithful retelling on that, in that level. In fact, there's a lot of the lines that you might even remember from the first film.
Oh, really?
Like when at one point, he early on, before Aladdin becomes Prince Ali, one of the soldiers marching through the town tells him, "You are born a street rat, you will die a street rat.
Okay.
And only your fleas will mourn you."
Oh.
And it's lines that come directly from these classic lines.
Okay.
There's a few others that come later to do with the denouement that, again, I recognise from the first film. Because obviously, like you, having a daughter growing up when that film was first out on video, you
you pretty much memorise it, don't you?
Worn out the old video tape watching that one.
So we're on the same page here, right? Yes. So yeah, so there'll be a lot that's very, 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 very comfortable and very familiar.
Yeah.
There is a little bit of an attempt to make it slightly less overwhelmingly male. So Jasmine has a new song that wasn't in the original. It's still written by what's his name? I can't think of the I don't have my notes in front of me. It's terrible, isn't it?
Wasn't one of the learners or something, was it?
No, Learner and Low. You're going back a bit there, mate.
Okay.
No, who was the music director? Alan Menken. That's you, right?
Okay.
It wasn't Tim Rice writing the lyrics, yes. But Alan Menken still wrote the score and he wrote the music.
Okay.
There's a new song called Silenced or Silent. And it's basically her singing, I will not be silenced any longer.
Oh, okay.
So they're trying to give Jasmine, in this version it's Naomi Scott, a bit more of a role, so she's not simply a foil for Aladdin.
Right.
But other than that, it's a very, very faithful retelling of the original story. Fair enough. And you've got Maynard Masood as Aladdin. And he actually looks like the original cartoon character.
Mm-hmm.
I think possibly that's why he was. Yeah, I don't think it was his singing ability.
Okay.
He's very adequate.
Okay.
He's very, very competent, and that's about all. Unfortunately.
Okay.
See, you got Guy Ritchie directing.
Interesting.
And so if you're expecting Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Lanterns, you're not going to get it.
No.
There's brief moments when you get a little bit of the kind of classic verve that Richie pulled off in films like Lock, Stock or Snatch, but there's not a whole lot of it. It's fairly restrained, but it's gorgeous to look at.
Mm-hmm.
It's colourful, it's beautiful, it's fantastic. It's really, really well done on that level. You've got Marwan Kenzan as Jafar, chewing significantly less scenery than I would have liked for a role like that.
Wow.
Again, kind of understated.
Yeah.
And the other thing that's been addressed in this is the original film was accused of whitewashing.
Yes.
You've got a film set in assorted Middle Easternness, and there wasn't a single non-white voice in it. Now, this time round, there is exactly one white face. Prince of Sweden who shows up as a suitor for Jasmine and is dismissed as a complete clown.
Okay.
So if you can have a white person in a film like that, then make sure he is completely dismissed as an idiot.
Okay.
And so you know the racial politics is entirely better handled. You know, it's set in non-specific Middle Easternness.
Yes.
And so the cast is non-specifically.
Yes.
You've got Will Smith is African-American. You've got Naomi Scott, who is English of Indian extraction. Maynard Masood is Egyptian, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got a decent mix from that part of the world. And there's the occasional minaret that appears in the fantastically done scenery. Right?
Yes.
So it's a perfectly nice film.
I'm waiting for you to tell me about Will Smith's performance as the genie, because
I know, and that's the thing.
That's what's going to make this film fly or not. Just excuse the pun.
And there you go. So you obviously got a whole new world.
Yes,
it's very nice. It's very well done.
Yes.
And then there's the genie.
Yes.
Right. And
go on. Tell me.
And see, there's you know the one scene where Prince Ali arrives in Agrabah.
Mm-hmm.
Prince Ali, happy is he, Ali. You know, right? And I swear, the elephant that he rode in on is now in the room.
Okay.
Because I'm trying very hard to avoid talking about Will Smith.
You are.
Because, let's face it, you're on a fool's errand, aren't you? Trying to follow that.
Ah, yeah.
So you can't possibly imitate it.
No.
You will fail.
Yeah, you have to do something different, surely.
Right. And if we never had Robin Williams, to quote James in a song called Sit Down, there's a line that says, if I hadn't seen such riches, I could live with being poor.
Okay.
And if we'd never known Robin Williams, we would have been perfectly happy. With a very sedate, very calm, very unremarkable genie. There was a couple of brief moments when he threatened to kind of bust out a little bit.
Okay.
But you could imagine that Robin Williams probably either drank a lifetime supply of coffee before he did that role, or possibly other things we wouldn't possibly like to suggest. But the manic energy that he brought to it, apparently most of it was improvised. That was just completely absent. It was underplayed, understated.
So the question then is, where does your, watching this latest film, where does the focus go? Where do your allegiances go as you're watching the film? In the animated film, Williams was such a skyrocket of talent that you were waiting for every next scene of his to dazzle you with his wit and his delivery. So that's, I guess what you're telling me is that's not happening in this film.
Yeah. I think your Freudian slip at the start of this review was so telling, wasn't it? Because you so intimately associate the film with Williams.
Yes, that's true.
He is the sine qua non of that film.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, without him, it's like the rest of the film has to stand on its own merits.
Yeah.
And it's perfectly pleasant.
Well, I don't think I'd want to. I wouldn't want to see a film like that just to see a perfectly pleasant film.
No.
In fact, I thought about it and I thought, why would I want to see this film? Would I want to see this film?
Well, in fact, I'll take it a step further. Why was it even made? And we know that Disney are going through this thing of plundering their own back catalogue.
Yeah.
And Jungle Book got all kinds of plaudits. Mm. For good reason. Lion King is looking like it could be something a bit special, even though that first trailer was creepy. Dumbo was a huge misstep.
Mm.
And so you take a film like that, what do you do? I mean, like I say, Will Smith was onto a hiding to nothing.
He was.
Yeah, if he tries to be Robin Williams, he will only fail. Yes. It is impossible to imitate.
Yes.
If he doesn't try and be Robin Williams, then he either has to do something else,
yes,
which will then be held up against Robin Williams and be found wanting,
yeah,
or the sense I got was don't bother trying.
Yeah. Oh, well. I've made my decision, thanks, Steve.
Look, here's the thing. If you've got a little kid now,
yes,
don't show them the video first.
No.
Don't let Robin Williams be their first taste. Take them and see this first.
Yes.
Let them enjoy it. Will Smith is perfectly functional.
Yes.
Mina Massoud is actually really quite sweet on screen. He really is. I quite like him. Naomi Scott is absolutely gorgeous.
Yes.
And she's got an amazing presence. The two of them work really nicely together. And they even give the genie a girlfriend.
Oh, do they indeed?
Well, kind of anyway.
Okay.
Jasmine has a handmaid. Who wasn't?
Okay.
Who now becomes an actual character.
Right. Okay.
But show your kids that first.
Yes.
And once they've enjoyed it, you say, right. You think that was good sunshine?
Yes.
Let us show you how it's meant to be done.
Yeah.
That's how you're going to do it. Because otherwise, no, I'm sorry, it doesn't hold up. It's making all the dollars. We know it is.
Yeah. But there's probably a huge curiosity factor in that. But anyway, I'm not convinced. I'm not going to go see it.
No, don't entirely blame me, to be honest.
No.
So I'm doing my best to sell it. And quite frankly, you know, I'm not doing it, am I?
No. Never mind.
So tell me about something good.
Well, look, it's our business, isn't it, in Crave? And our website cravepodcast.com to generally be talking about films and music that's happening right now. But every now and then a film comes along and you think, oh, I like the look of that, and for whatever reason you don't get to see it.
Yeah.
And that's where I was with a particular film which several thousand feet up in the air coming home from an overseas trip just last week. I got the opportunity to watch a film that was said to be Robert Redford's last acting role, The Old Man and the Gun.
The Old Man, because he's in his 80s, isn't he?
I think he's at 80.
Now, is he directing this one as well?
No, he's not directing.
Okay, fair enough. So what's the story?
It's kind of like Butch Cassidy in 2019.
a little bit.
So, and I say that because he plays a real character, a real life character called Forrest Tucker, who was an American, an elderly man who was a career criminal, career bank robber.
Okay.
caught many times, sent to prison many times, escaped many times, kept going back to robbing banks, and did it in a very, and this is the key, in a very non-threatening, gentlemanly, witty, charming even way, with a few couple of accomplices.
Okay, I can see how Robert Redford could slide into that. Yeah,
and he had a gun in his possession, but never used it or really threatened to use it in any sort of serious way. And so the film tells the story of this character. He's right at the end of his career. He's got two mates are Tom Waits and Danny Glover are his sidekicks in crime, and it follows them through a sequence of robberies. He happens to meet a woman called Sissy Spacek. The actor becomes a love interest in the film.
Okay, yeah.
And we also catch up with the detective who's determined to track him down and find him, who's played by Casey Affleck. And Redford, it's just effortless, an effortless, easy performance that still has a little twinkle in his eye. I saw him when I was 9 or 10 in Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
Yeah.
And the Sundance, well, both of them, Newman and Redford, I mean, that was just a beautiful chemistry that they had. And I think people still think very fondly of that. They just had this way about them that was funny and serious. And again, they just looked like they're having the time of their lives making that film.
Yeah.
It doesn't have a Newman character, but in many other respects, it feels like it is almost the Sundance Kid. A sweet sundown for the Sundance Kid coming back.
Love it.
And just taking us through a similar role.
Yeah.
Bank robberies, which is what they did. And it's not a rip snorter of a film.
Yep.
It's a pleasant, whimsical, funny.
Whimsical's not the word that springs to mind with the description.
Whimsical's not quite the right word, but it's not a hard hitting film.
Right. Yeah.
It's
not Reservoir Dogs, is it?
No, you're just going to sit back and enjoy it. There's some nice humour in it.
Okay.
A little bit of tension. And just some very nice acting going on and a good script. And it's sort of a play, I guess, on that sort of character that Redford has played, occupied in the past. And so I would, you know, if you didn't catch it the first time around, obviously. And,
no, I didn't, no.
And if you happen to see it somewhere on a Netflix at some point or something like that, I'd really recommend it. It's something about... something about seeing a guy almost reprise something that he did that has stayed with him throughout his career, and it's still something about it still there. Right.
Well, tying this back into our first conversation of the of this episode, we were talking about the Monkees.
Yes.
Is he Mickey Dolenz, who's still got it and still belting it out, or is he Mike Nesmith trading on past glories?
Oh, no, he's not Mike Nesmith, because he is... I think his credentials in directing and producing and acting are pretty solid.
Right.
And he's done some quite good work in this latter part of his life, I think.
Right.
And I think it looks like he's having a really nice time doing this film. It's to a certain extent, it's a kind of a deadpan performance.
Yeah, with
But no, very much the Dolenz, not the Nesmith. So,
fair enough. Yeah. Now, the thing is, right, I mean, you sold me on this, and I'm concerned about that.
I know what you're going to say.
Because I have to take you to task on... You sold me a few... about 2 months ago, you sold me about one. Now, what was it called? Was it Black or Dark Summer? I can't remember the title.
I think it was Black... was it Black Summer or Dark Summer? Yes, it was a zombie movie on Netflix. Not series on Netflix, which I thought was great. And you
did.
And it was... The basis of my recommendation, you poor man, you went and watched it.
I had a long flight ahead of me. That seems to be what we do these days, isn't it? watch stuff on flight. So I downloaded this entire series onto my iPad and hopped on a plane. And I watched the first 5 episodes on the way out.
Yes.
And then on the way back, I watched the second 5 episodes, hoping it was going to get better. Because, like you say, it's a zombie story,
Yes.
That's it. That's all you can say about it. It's a zombie story. I mean, it doesn't have a beginning. It's like you're dropped into the middle of
a zombie thing. Event.
Well, that's it. We don't even know what's going. We don't even. I mean, they're like zombies, but there are differences from conventional zombies.
Yes.
But we're never actually given reasons why.
No.
If you're going to violate the conventions of a genre, you have to justify that, and they never do.
No, they don't. I didn't mind that, Steve.
Well,
you're not wrong what you say, and you your summary of it. This wasn't giving you a lot of backstory. It was like, bang, we're in the middle of it.
Yeah.
It's moving along at a reasonable clip. We're not given a lot of explanation. You're right. But I liked it. This is where, for me, the style or the delivery engaged me enough that I didn't worry about those other things.
Oh, okay. I was just waiting for it to resolve itself.
Right.
And it doesn't.
No.
It just ends. So we never really found out what caused the zombie apocalypse. Like you say, there's no backstory. You just hit the ground running. And the other thing that I have to give you a hard time for, just a little bit.
Okay.
You told me that you thought I'd be able to understand the Japanese woman because she speaks only Japanese.
Yes.
I didn't understand a single word she said.
Well, she was speaking Japanese, wasn't she?
No, it was Korean.
You're kidding.
What was it?
Oh, okay. I thought it was Japanese.
No,
oh.
I mean, to be fair...
Well, it wasn't...
I will tell you, when I first moved to Japan, back in 91...
How embarrassing.
I was trying to think of 92 this was. I've been there for about 6 months. I remember turning the TV on.
Okay.
And I was really proud of myself. I actually knew a few words of
right.
Japanese. And I turned the TV on, and there was this soap opera type show.
Yes.
And I was trying to tune into it really hard, trying to figure out why I couldn't make out any of the words. And eventually I discovered it was Korean.
Okay.
But I didn't know. I'd lived in Japan for 6 months at this stage, and I didn't notice. I just thought it was Japanese that I couldn't understand.
Right. Okay, well,
so,
my apologies then.
Yeah.
And you've got me on that one.
Yeah, I just had to give you a quick answer for that, yeah.
But I guess the point was, it was a foreign language being spoken.
Yeah, that was
no subtitles.
That was an interesting device because you've got this character who speaks maybe three words of English, possibly four.
Yeah.
She was so out of her depth.
Yes.
That was a very, very interesting device.
Yeah.
Because there was, it gave you a sense of how much panic she was in. She had no clue what was being said around her.
Mm.
And it must have been utterly terrifying for her. So that was an interesting device. But yeah, other than that, it was the most unsatisfying watch.
Okay. Well, it would be boring if we agreed all the time.
It would.
Okay.
It would. So let's have a quick discussion of what we're going to disagree on next.
Shall we? So well, because we are in the winter here now, so it's not the prime time for bands to be touring, but have we got anything?
It's a prime time for bands to be announcing.
Oh, announcing. Okay.
Yeah. So
okay.
So sticking with the old stuff.
Yeah.
Michael Bublé.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. Calm down.
Yes.
He's going to be playing. Now, where is he? He's not going to be coming locally. I can't find the date now, because he's coming to Mission Estate Winery in Hawke's Bay.
Okay.
That's going to be Saturday, the 1st of February next year.
Okay, right on.
Okay. Who else have we got? Bastille, a up-and-coming-ish British rock band. And
yes.
I say up-and-coming. Where are they playing? I've lost it now. Spark Arena, they're coming to on the 23rd of January.
Right.
My daughter's quite impressed with that one, so she can do an idea of the time frame we're working with there.
Yes.
Slightly older, Stiff Little Fingers.
Okay, they've been around for a while, haven't they, Steve?
Well, put it this way, it's the 40th anniversary of their debut album.
Okay.
So that gives you an idea. Now, they're doing 3 dates over here. 25th of February, they're going to be in Christchurch at the Foundry.
Mm-hmm.
Then they're working the way north, 26th, Wellington, the San Fran, and they're up to Auckland on the 27th at the power station.
Okay.
So if you want a bit of Irish punk, there you guys. We've got, sticking with the British acts from long ago, were you a fan of Squeeze?
There was a bunch of British bands, I guess,
that
I was familiar with. So are they 70s or 80s, Squeeze?
Late 70s, early to mid 80s.
Probably just one of those bands that I was aware of. I probably would have heard some songs of theirs on the radio, but never bought an album.
Right.
So I can't say I was a big fan.
No, I mean, if I put on their Greatest Hits album, you'd know most of it.
Okay.
You'd know songs like Pulling Muscles from the Shell or Cool for Cats or Up the Junction. Cracking music.
Yeah,
really, really good stuff. Now they're coming to. I mean, I saw them Sheffield University, 1988.
Wow.
Oh yes, and they were good then, but they've not got Jules Holland playing with them, I don't think, any longer, which is a big shame. But 7th of February is a Friday, Auckland Town Hall.
Mm-hmm.
I'm hoping to be there.
Okay.
Saturday the 8th, Isaac Theatre Royal in Christchurch, and then Sunday the 9th is the Opera House in Wellington.
Okay.
And then they're off to a different country that we don't like to.
Okay.
Talk about Auckland band.
Yes.
Are you familiar with Push Push?
I've heard of Push Push, but I'm not familiar with them.
Well, you're probably more familiar with their singer, Mickey Havoc.
Oh, yes. Okay.
Yeah. He's just packed in his gig on the radio.
Okay.
Because Push Push are reforming to open up for Kiss in December.
Oh, my God, really?
Yeah, Tuesday, December the 3rd, they're going to be at Spark Arena. And I think they're going to be better than Kiss are, quite frankly.
Well, I wonder if Kiss will bring back, was it Ace Frehley who did that solo show a year or so back, which is one of
Don't put yourself through this anymore,
yeah,
Simon. Anymore.
The worst show I've seen since I've been doing Craig. I think it was. Anyway.
It was certainly the one that failed to meet expectations by the biggest margin.
Yeah, yeah.
Certainly.
I'm going to mention one, because I've, and this is a local one.
Go on, and then I'll do the big one.
So a band I saw a couple of summers ago at Western Springs, and a city council organised big festival day. It's Drax Project, they're called.
Yes, yes.
They're playing the Auckland Town Hall the 27th of July. They're from Wellington. I like them. One of those bands, I think I've seen it more than once now, where this lead singer plays saxophone as well.
Right, and I think you saw them opening for Ed Sheeran.
Yes, we did. And they've got an album coming out, their debut album coming out very soon.
Right.
And so in Auckland anyway, I'm not sure where they're playing elsewhere around the country, but they're certainly playing in Auckland on Saturday, the 27th of July. I think they'd be worth a look.
July? That's yep. really soon.
Yeah, very soon.
Absolutely. But even though it's probably not the most exciting one, it's probably the biggest name that's coming.
Oh, I know what you're going to say.
Yeah.
I think I do.
You probably. Who do you think I'm going to mention?
You're going to mention U2, aren't
you? I'm going to mention U2, yes. Now, they're only doing the one date over here. Actually, no, that's not true.
It's a second date.
They've announced a second date. So that came out today, didn't
yes.
it? So we'll mention the original date they announced is the 8th of November
yep.
at Mount Smart Stadium. And now I have to go and look in my email because it came in so recently. I haven't had a chance to post it on the website yet. But they are going to be doing a second
yes.
show. And that's going to be on Saturday, November the 9th. Again,
at Mount Smart
Stadium.
Apparently the first show sold out in an hour.
Oh, I was surprised it took that long.
Yeah, and this is have I got this right? This is a show where they're playing the whole of the Joshua Tree.
Yes, well, it's the nth anniversary, isn't
right.
it?
I'm not sure if they're playing other material as well. I presume they are.
Well, I would hope so. It's only one album.
Yeah.
I mean, to be fair, I saw U2 at the same time I saw Squeeze.
Okay.
And oddly enough, it was actually on the Joshua Tree tour.
Okay.
And I saw them at Elland Road Stadium in Leeds.
Right.
And they came on stage, if I remember correctly, they opened with a Chuck Berry cover. They did Come On Everybody.
Mm-hmm.
They played for an hour,
mm-hmm.
went off stage, came on, did a half hour encore, and that was it. The music was good. I mean, don't get me wrong, they were absolutely fine on stage.
Yes.
But it was one of the most strangely put together sets.
Oh, okay.
I mean, it was up there with the Red Hot Chili Peppers mm-hmm. in terms of weirdly constructed sets, you know. But yeah, I mean, they were perfectly good. I'm looking
yes.
forward to seeing them, I have to be honest, because
yes.
I do like the music.
Well, I think the Joshua, well, as you probably know, I think we might have discussed this before, the Joshua Tree is an album which really has a particular place in the hearts of many New Zealanders because of the song One Tree Hill.
Yes.
Which is about One Tree Hill in Auckland.
Quite literally, yes.
And is dedicated to a Kiwi roadie who sadly
yes.
died on that tour.
Yes.
So, I remember hearing that song. They came to, I saw them in Western Springs in the 80s when they did a tour with B.B. King.
Oh, wow.
Which was great. It was the Love Comes to Town tour.
Well, it would be, wouldn't it? Yes.
And
so that would be shortly after I saw them, because they'll be promoting Rattle and Hum.
Yes, that's right.
Yes.
So anyway, they've been in a number of times, and I've not seen them since, but I've heard from people who have gone along to see them that they put on an absolutely fantastic show. And I think the interest in this, because of the Joshua Tree, will be even greater.
Yes. And it was their last true rock album, really, wasn't it, before they started going all electronic-y?
Yeah, yeah.
They did, was it Zooropa?
That's right.
And then Achtung Baby, which was an amazing album with an atrocious title.
Strange.
Yeah, but it was a genuinely good album.
Yeah.
It's one that you have to listen to with really good bass speakers, because it will have them really going. So again, that's U2. And what's of greater interest possibly than U2 themselves is a support act.
Okay.
It's going to be Noel Gallagher's High Flying Birds.
How does that work out?
I have no idea.
Why would he want... That's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, you would think that the Noel Gallagher's ego would be such
yeah.
that he would do support to Nomad.
Yes.
To be fair, that Bono is possibly the only man with a bigger ego than Noel Gallagher. That could be it. But it's a surprising choice, isn't it?
It is. Oh, well. Well, it makes for a heck of a double act, that's for sure.
Absolutely. So that's going to be, let's just mention that again, 8th of November at Mount Smart Stadium, with a second date that's just been announced on the 9th before they then swan over to Australia, and then they're going up to Tokyo and South Korea.
I'm pretty sure I heard on the radio as we driving in to record this podcast and videocast today, Steve, that on next, what day of the week is it today?
Today's a Tuesday.
I think it's Monday of next week, the second. Oh, that doesn't sound right, does it? I wouldn't delay it that long. Anyway, I'm just thinking of when these tickets for the second show are going.
Well, if only there were a press release we could look at.
Anyway,
let's
keep an eye out for it. If
tickets to go on sale, you're right, Monday, June the 17th at 1 p.m.
Right, next Monday.
Yeah,
okay.
So there's a bit of a lead in. So if you didn't get your tickets, I mean, let's face it, whatever you think of Bono and his ego and the pretentious stuff he was doing, phoning the Pope from stage back in the 90s, they are one of the biggest rock bands in modern history.
Yeah, they are.
They really are. And they are also known for putting on monumental stage shows.
Yeah, really good. Okay, fantastic.
So some good stuff coming up there, Simon.
Lovely. All right, well, I think done the houses rather well this time around, Steve. Look, it's great to bring you another, I was going to say broadcast. It's not a broadcast. It's nearly a broadcast, but it is a podcast and a video cast. We'd like to hear from
it's
you.
All, so it's all the casts.
It's all the casts. We cast a wide net. And you can...
Cast away, Simon. Cast away.
Anyway, if you want to drop us a line, if you want to agree or disagree with what Steve and I have been yabbering on about...
Yeah, after puns like that, Simon, you think anyone's going to drop us a line ever? Everyone's ever going to talk to us again?
Possibly not.
Wouldn't you blame them, really, would you?
Podcast at cravepodcast is our email address.
This is why we don't get emails, Simon.
Did I get it wrong again?
Yes, you did.
What did I just say?
Podcast at cravepodcast. What did you miss?
.com.
Thank you. So we'll take another swing at that.
Sorry. You're dealing with professionals here, Steve. Podcast at cravepodcast.com.
Thank you.
Is where our legions of followers can write us an email.
This is why we don't get emails, you know that. You can find us on Twitter or on Facebook at Crave Podcast, and also on Instagram. I forgot to mention that one.
Oh, yeah.
We're on
true.
Instagram as well. We're all over social media. We're not on LinkedIn. That's the one place we refuse to go. We should get on MySpace.
Okay. Is MySpace the one where the images don't last that long?
No, that's Snapchat. Now, MySpace is what came before Facebook in the early
2000s. Yeah. Anyway, we could yabber on about social media for hours. Thank you very much for joining us today. I'm Simon Mercer.
I'm Steve McCabe.
And I'll let you finish.
That is indeed what's been, well, kind of entertaining is this week.
Good start.
Why not? I think that went about as well as could be expected, don't you?
I think it was a bit of fun, actually.